As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Jonathan Ferro, along with Lisa Abramowitz and Anne-Marie Hordern. Join us each day for insight from the best in markets, economics, and geopolitics. From our global headquarters in New York City, we are live on Bloomberg Television weekday mornings from 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen. And as always, on the Bloomberg Terminal and the Bloomberg Business App.
We begin with our top story. Meta's outlook dragging futures lower with more big tech earnings on deck. Chris Harvey of Wells Fargo with the most bullish year-end S&P 500 target on the street, writing this: we expect near-term choppiness related to outlooks and rising rates. Our S&P 500 target is 55-35, but we're more focused on the return profile. Stay in the game, but you need some portfolio hedges. Chris is with us now for more. Chris, good morning to you.
Good morning.
55-35 up from 46-25. That's a big change. Can we start there? What changed?
That is a big change. So we knew we were going to move numbers higher. We just didn't know how much higher, because I didn't know, you know, we looked at things last year and we were up, we were expecting the market to be up 10%, maybe 15. And we couldn't figure out, you know, that was pretty good at the time, but we missed the market by 10%. What we figured out is the market's just being a lot more aggressive on how it's discounting. It's discounting a lot further into the future. And it's using a much more aggressive forward multiple. And so when we took that into consideration, we realized, hey, we can get to 270 on 2025. We can use a 2021 multiple, and that gets us over 5,500. And so that's really how we got there. And what we think is going to happen is not the economy is going to be really strong. It's a mix shift. The winners are going to keep winning, and the more profitable companies are going to make up a bigger percentage of the S&P 500, and that's how you're going to get there.
So within this is a big core bet on mega-cap tech.
Mega-cap tech, but really more profitable companies. A lot of the mega-cap tech are those, but it's not every single mega-cap tech is a profitable company. But yes, along those lines.
Is there anything in the earnings that you've seen or the spending by said companies that makes you concerned?
No, what makes me concerned is we really haven't learned anything new at this point in time. Consumer, still value-oriented, still selective. High-end's doing better than low-end. Kind of knew that. People like to travel, services over goods and things. We knew that as well. Economy's a little bit stronger than expected. Not new news. What we're waiting for and what we're looking for and what we think is this AI spend, it's not a discretionary spend. And we'll see that going forward. Maybe that's part of what we saw last night. And what we think is, again, you're going to have a separation. You've already had that separation between the winners and losers. That separation is just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger.
The separation has been in earnings returns, but it's also been in earnings, right. Just straight out. We saw Southwest, for example, coming out earlier this morning, underperforming, wider loss. You say people right. like to travel. There are signs that that's actually being challenged on the margins. We just got results from American Air, similar type of disappointment. Right. How much does this make you shift some of the companies that you like? Is this basically a bet that the cash winners and the AI darlings can keep going, but the broadening out isn't going to happen?
Yeah, so Lisa, there's a lot there, right? If we look at Delta, Delta's a lot different than Southwest. And Delta had a lot more positive things. It's a higher end consumer. It's also more business oriented. Right. What do we like? What's going to change? Well, the bigger question is we see two trades in the marketplace. It's the momentum trade and it's a reinflation trade. And I think that momentum trade will continue because, again, the winners will keep winning. As far as our positioning, what we want to do and what we've been doing for the last year and a half is we want to barbell communications with something more defensive. Now what we want to do is barbell communications with healthcare or utilities. We want some balance. We want some protection in that portfolio, but we do want to participate to the upside.
If the Fed doesn't cut this year or only cuts once, how do you change your target again?
Don't change it at all.
Really?
Yeah, because the reason is if you go back to 21 when the Fed was way too aggressive and then you roll into 22, you ran into a buzzsaw. Why was that? Well, you were too accommodative in 21 and then you turned everything on its head in 22. Well, you're not going to see that going forward. You're going to see a Fed that's going to cut. It's going to be a multi-year cut, multi-year easing cycle. And that continuity is going to help. What else is backing that up? This secular AI trade is not going anywhere. It's actually broadening out to power, to electrification. And then the M&A story keeps getting better and better and better. So whether it's one cut, two cuts, three cuts, we don't care because it's the start of a bigger cycle.
I know it's no one's really base case, but what if there was a hike? How would that change your outlook?
Yeah, that won't be good. And what we tell people is today, if today's...
But that's the risk of increased U.S. exceptionalism.
Well, I don't know about that. But what I do tell people is if today was your first day on the job, you would not be coming to the conclusion the Fed needs to cut, right? The economy's stronger than expected. We're in a bull market with equities. Credit spreads are less than 90 basis points. The consumer's fine. And while the Fed says things are tight, yeah, I see parts where it's tight, but when it's really tight, people don't have to tell you. You feel it, you know it. I'm surprised that the Fed is telegraphing easing as much as it has and why they pivoted in December so hard. That's to me, is very surprising.
My favorite line of yours over the last few years, brace yourself. I think you might know, you might have guessed. Coming out of the pandemic, I remember in 2020, you said it's going to be spring break for adults.
Yeah.
Did you expect it to last this long?
I did not.
Is it over yet?
It's toward the, we're late in the cycle. We're toward the tail end.
The longest spring break ever.
It is a long spring break. Has been bad, though.
We're trying to work out what to do with discretionary based on that. And that was ultimately the call coming out of the pandemic. It was spring break for adults, discretionary, go, go, go.
Right.
What is it now?
I think it's more producers over consumers, right? The consumer, again, is... they've spent what they needed to spend. They've done their revenge spending, right? They're being a lot more selective. They're saying, I'm not gonna spend a lot for that. If I can jump on a plane and go and travel, I will do that. But goods and day-to-day things, I've got enough stuff, right? And so now that AI trade, right, that's the secular trade. The discretionary spending is not AI. It's a non-discretionary spend. And it's beginning to build out, right? You have the secondary and tertiary trades. The data centers, the power issue surrounding that, the electrification. And so I think if you're looking for a narrative, consumer is probably producers over consumer, but really it's that AI trade, it's that momentum trade. It's still a GARP growthy market in our opinion.
You mentioned M&A, and I have to go there because it's something we've been talking about a lot.
Yeah.
How much M&A can happen given some of the recent FTC action?
Well, that's a great question. And one of the things we keep saying, one of the things that we think will happen, right? People ask us, how do you handicap elections? What do you do? And the thing that we look at is who's going to control the Senate, right? Who controls the Senate is very important. If the GOP takes control of the Senate, that's much better for equity markets. And I think this time around, it's going to be much better for M&A because the regulatory environment is very difficult for M&A and M&A activity. And so if you see that change in the Senate, I think that helps accelerate longer term M&A and the M&A cycle.
So aside from a rate hike by the Federal Reserve, what could crack your confidence in this type of return as we parse through which data matters most?
How long do you have?
We've got time.
We've got time. So right now it's rates. I'm really worried about rates because equity and rates, there is this momentum component where I buy strength, I sell weakness. So you can see rates gap up pretty quickly, right? We're above, I think we're 460, 460 and change. You could see four and three quarters, 5% very, very quickly. The other thing is expectations. Are we seeing people just managing expectations or are they telling us something different? And then the last thing in the equity market, it's the same thing, right? I buy strength, I sell weakness. Well, a downturn of 3, 4, 5% can turn into a 7, 8, 9, 10% sell-off very, very quickly. So those are some of the things that we're worried about right now.
Chris, this was great. It's good to catch up. It's been too long.
Yeah, it's
good to see you, mate. Thank you. Chris Harvey there of Wells Fargo.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's go through this economic data with Blarina Yuruchi of T. Rowe Price. She joins us now. Blarina, this is an interesting mix of data with the emphasis on interesting. You've got a big downside surprise on GDP. You've got core PCE price index quarter on quarter coming in a bit hotter than expected. Jobless claims a little bit lower than expected. Where would you place the emphasis this morning?
So I think it's very important to unpack the components of GDP and what led to this slowing in growth in Q1. So overall, I would say this is not a worrying report for the Fed. It's a report that says the economy continues to expand at a solid pace. Look at consumption growth at about 2.5%. This is a healthy consumer that is backed up by the claims data where unemployment claims are low and job growth remains strong when you look at the payroll data. So overall, it's a report that says to the Fed the economy is not reaccelerating. It's slowing from the pace of growth in the second half of last year. That is telling the Fed that those interest rate increases may be having some effect in slowing demand, particularly for goods, but it's not alarming by any means. And then what I like to do with this GDP report is to sort of look at the final domestic sales and final sales to domestic private actors in the economy. And that's, again, that's showing 2.5% to 3.5% growth in Q1. It's not telling us that the economy is that weak after all. And I think a big drag here is also coming from net inventory contribution, which Michael already alluded to.
So we want to talk about the sustainability of this economic growth that we're seeing, because so many people are piling onto this story of US exceptionalism. Away from the top line number, which is a clear and obvious downside surprise, the sources of growth in the first quarter, Blarina, can we talk about that? Do you see that continuing through 2024?
Yeah, so there are a couple of interesting things here. Let's start with business investment. This has been driven by structures investment in the past and intellectual property investment as the housing market was really retrenching throughout 22 and 23 and res investment collapsed. Now we're seeing a rebound in res investment. And I think this is going to be sustained this year because there is really a dearth of housing in the housing market. We don't have inventory and home builders will start building again. And we're seeing that in Q1. So I think this will remain supportive of growth. Also, the point that we've made in the past together in this show is that I think the consumer, the U.S. consumer, will continue to keep its wallet open so long as we don't have layoffs and layoff data are not screaming weak signs now and so long as we continue to add jobs. And then Michael McKee already discussed this problem of historical residual seasonality with Q1 GDP growth, which means that oftentimes Q1, also Q2, tends to be weaker than the second half of the year. So we need to be cautious of this as well. Now, the question, the bigger question that I think you're also trying to allude to is, where is potential growth for the economy? How fast can we grow beyond potential this year? And this is the big question mark this year because we don't know the effect of this shock to the labor supply from migrant workers that we received last year.
Blarina, the market seems to emphasize, as John was pointing out, the inflation figures as well as the jobless claims coming in lighter than expected. Is this what the Fed would focus on as well? Would they focus more on inflationary pressures than they would, say, on slowing growth?
What the Fed has told us is that they're not concerned about the strong growth numbers and the strong employment numbers, and their focus remains inflation. So in that sense, it makes sense. I think they'll look at the GDP numbers through this lens too. But at the same time, there's no new information really in the PCE deflator for Q1 because we've already received January and February data for PCE. We knew that that beat expectations. We largely have the components of March PCE see because of the CPI reports and the PPI reports that we've received in recent weeks. And so I'm surprised that the market should focus so much on the Q1 GDP deflator, because there's no new information there as far as I'm concerned.
Blarina, great to catch up with you. I just want to get a final question, if we can, looking ahead to the Federal Reserve next week. What is going to be the big topic of focus for you at that FOMC meeting? Do you expect any big changes to the statement at all?
So I would say that they want to be a little bit cautious about how sanguine they are on the number of cuts that they will be able to deliver this year, given the strength of economic data, the labor market, and the upside surprises to inflation. So I do think they will emphasize that they have a dovish bias, but it's uncertain whether they'll be able to deliver on that March SEP and the dot plot. So I'm watching for signs that they want to back off from three cuts this year.
Got it. Blarina, thank you.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Michael Hirschen of 22V Research joins us around the table. Michael, good morning to you.
Morning.
Let's get into this. I heard it from Yellen. We're going to hear it from Blinken. When do we start to see the policy?
Well, I think a sanctions push is something that the U.S. is not going to take lightly, especially on a major Chinese bank. And I think, frankly, the Chinese banks are taking this pretty seriously as well. So I would guess that this move is not imminent, but you have to take the threat seriously.
Is the warning enough for the Chinese banks to change course?
I think for the large banks, Beijing will let them manage their own sanctions risk. I think it's more likely that we would see something that would be one of the smaller banks. Now, that could be still a large bank in absolute terms, but what we've seen with Iran, with North Korea, is it's typically the sanctions risk is really embedded in the smaller Chinese financial institutions.
There's a plethora of issues Tony Blinken is going to want to bring up today, whether it's China bringing more Iranian crude, whether it's China supporting Russia, if not outright, but through these things like helping them with the materials they need, TikTok, South China Sea. What is the main request they need to ask? Overcapacity. What do you go in there and say, you need to sort this immediately?
I think it is a long list, as you said. I don't think that Blinken is going to carry the water, so to speak, on trade. I think that's really a discussion left to trade officials. I mean, clearly he's going to make that point. But I think higher on Blinken's agenda will be China's support for Russia, Iran and the nexus to the Israel-Gaza conflict, and then South China Sea. You have, you know, a flashpoint that people sometimes sleep on, but is really serious with the tensions between China and the Philippines. That could bring the U.S. in, you know, potentially quite easily, in the sense that the U.S. is a treaty ally with the Philippines. So if we see an accidental collision, some kind of miscalculation between China and the Philippines, that issue moves right to the front burner.
How much do you think that the conversation is going to sound something like this? Tony Blinken to the ambassador or even Xi Jinping, we're so much better than the other guy will be, so work with us.
I don't think that will be an explicit part of the conversation, but the election certainly is on something that is on the minds of the Chinese. I think they don't want to see China become any more of the center of the U.S. election than they already are with an issue like TikTok. So it's an incentive for Beijing not to let these issues flare up too much. At the same time, it somewhat limits President Biden's negotiating leverage because the Chinese don't know who is going to be president a year from now. So the election is going to be something that's certainly on everyone's mind, but not explicitly raised in this conversation.
You said that trade is not going to be really the main issue. They're going to be talking about support to Russia and trade with Russia and some of the other sort of global interference with geopolitics on the part of China. How do you divorce the idea of trade from some of those issues at a time where economics increasingly is really determining the geopolitics.
They can't be divorced, and especially if you think about the excess capacity issue, it's one that's really tied to the strategic competition over clean energy. If you look at the export controls, which are a trade issue, right, limiting export of semiconductors to China, it directly links back to national security. So it is definitely going to be part of the conversation. The Chinese, I think, are going to push back quite forcefully on U.S. tech restrictions. They see this, they've been characterizing this as an obstacle to China's development. So it's getting closer to being sort of a core red line issue for China. So it absolutely is going to be part of the conversation. They can't be divorced.
Japan is going to be watching very carefully. Can we just build on this conversation that Lisa started? How do you think countries like the United States will maintain national security cooperation with countries like Japan at a time where maybe economic cooperation is tested? And I will use the word tested. I can think of Nippon Steel, looking at what's happening in the FX market. How do you maintain cooperation in one when cooperation in the other is a little bit fragile right now?
I think for US-Japan, this relationship is really very solid. I think there's a mutual interest there and enough time, spent on the relationship to be able to see through issues like Nippon Steel. The exchange rate, is an issue. I think it's the same issue on the Chinese side, right? Dollar yuan has got the same issues as dollar yen. And there you have the prospect of these geopolitics seeping in there as well. So it's a complicated balancing act also on the Chinese side as we think about these exchange rate developments.
What did you make of what happened last week in Washington, D.C.? What was your impression of the meeting that Japan and South Korea had with the Treasury Secretary?
Clearly, it's showing, interest on both sides in managing these exchange rate movements. It's a complicated task. I think, as you were saying, one of the questions is, when do they intervene? How do they intervene? We've just seen verbal intervention so far. I think, frankly, they're fighting against some pretty strong fundamentals in terms of the strength of the U.S. economy and the prospect that the Fed is going to be higher for longer. So there's limits, to how much FX intervention can do when the mismatch between the fundamentals are that strong.
When you're talking about allies like Japan, I also think of the European Union. How much is Secretary Blinken today going to rely on those allies and the fact that the Biden administration, as opposed to really the Trump administration, has taken a multilateral approach saying it's not just us, it's a group of us that you're going to have to contend with?
It's a big part of the conversation, and I think the Biden administration really wants and needs the Europeans to step up more on this issue of China's support for Russia and a number of these other flashpoints. On excess capacity, this is even more of an issue for European countries like Germany than it is necessarily for the U.S. economy. On Russia, Ukraine, it's even more of an existential threat to European security than it is to the U.S. So the U.S. is counting on the Europeans to do more. Whether they will do more remains to be seen. President Xi will be visiting France next month. That's going to be a really interesting test to see how forcefully the Europeans are going to push back.
How nervous do you think Tim Cook is in terms of its business, Apple's business right now in China? How at risk are some of the U.S. and, frankly, even European companies that rely on China for their business?
If I'm Tim Cook, I'd probably be more nervous about the macro situation in China, the fact that the consumer remains weak and that there's rising competition, than I would necessarily from the political risk. He's definitely got to manage that. But if we're thinking about an Apple or a Tesla, those are such bellwether companies in China's market that I think Beijing has to be careful about overt retaliation. This is, at a time when China's trying to revive confidence in the economy, a strike against an Apple or a Tesla would really chill the business environment. I think the U.S. firms that are more at risk of retaliation are, less of the brand name, marquee names, more closely tied to technology competition. Those are the areas that I think, those companies are more at risk. But frankly, Beijing does not have great options for retaliation at a time they're trying to revive the economy.
Michael, enjoyed this. Thanks for being with us, sir. Thank you very much. Michael Hurston there of 22V Research.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast, bringing you the best in markets, economics and geopolitics. You can watch the show live on Bloomberg TV weekday mornings from 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. Eastern. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify or anywhere else you listen. And as always, on the Bloomberg Terminal and the Bloomberg Business app.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month,
like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4x points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.